You're dangerous, 'cause you're honest. You're dangerous, you don't know what you want. Where you left my heart, empty as a vacant lot. For any spirit.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with you two and Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses, whose first lines are, "You're dangerous because you're honest, you're dangerous, you don't know what you are." Today's show looks at the danger of knowledge and power, of honesty and history, and that increasingly slippery concept, truth. When I think of truth, I think of the team of blindfolded people, each feeling a different part of an elephant and insisting their description is the truth of the entire elephant. In her new documentary film titled Rachel, Israeli filmmaker Simone Baton tries to get at the truth of 23-year-old Rachel Corrie's death on August 16, 2003. That day, U.S.-made Israeli-driven bulldozers had arrived to demolish the Nasrallah household in Rafah, Gaza Strip. Rachel Corrie from Olympia, Washington, refused to move out of the path of the bulldozer, and she was run over and crushed to death. In the documentary, Baton interviews and reviews testimony and eyewitness accounts of Rachel Corrie's death. This movie screened at the Jewish Film Festival in San Francisco recently and will be at the Rhoda Theater in Berkeley on August 4th. The Rhoda Theater in Berkeley, California on August 4th. Khalid Bendip of KPFA Radio's Voices of the Middle East and North Africa introduces the segment. Emilie Rossazan conducts the telephone interview with Simone Baton.
On March 16, 2003, Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old American activist from Olympia, Washington, was crushed to death by one of these bulldozers while attempting to prevent the home of a local pharmacist from being demolished. Despite a campaign spearheaded by the Israeli consulate in San Francisco and other Zionist activists and foundations to cancel the showing of the documentary film Rachel at the Jewish Film Festival, this film was shown on July 25th at the Castro Theater in San Francisco and will be screened in this year's edition of the festival at Berkeley's Rhoda Theater on August 4th. Menihe spoke with French-Israeli filmmaker Simone Baton about her cinematic investigation of Rachel Corrie's death.
The kind of films which are made only out of political tactic usually are very, very bad films. And I'm committed to cinema. You know, when I'm doing a film, my commitment is to cinema. So my motivations are professional and artistic. Mainly, there were a lot of versions about this story, about how she was killed, with a lot of contradictions, really. And there was no real investigation. There is no independent investigation into the death of Rachel Corrie until today. So, as a documentarist, for me, it was a challenge. I know very well this ground of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I've been making film there for more than 25 years now. And so I thought that I might be able to come up with something valuable on the investigative ground, which is what I did. This film is really an inquiry, and it is an independent one. So that was the first and most important motivation to this, all kind of much personal motivations, but this is another story.
What is so personal about it for you?
Well, it was very moving. It is something which resonated in me, you know. As I told you, I'm making films about this for so many years now. And also, I am aching, you know, the suffering of the people there and sharing for such a long time, the sufferings of the Palestinians and the suffering of the Israeli civilians. And it's a turning point. killing Rachel Corrie. It's the first time that a foreigner, a Westerner, foreigner who went there for solidarity purposes was killed by a military machine. It's a very important turning point, a symbolic one, because it is a small episode in a very big tragedy. But sometimes you have small episodes who are very symbolic because they touch something that was not touched until then. And this is the story of Rachel Corrie. A red line has been crossed.
In the beginning of your film, you were interviewing Major Avital Leibovich. Mm-hmm. She's Israeli Defense Force International spokesperson. Some of our listeners might remember her frequent appearance
You can see her all over.
All over. She was on CNN and BBC during the military assault on Gaza.
But you never see her for so long.
But she was there sort of to come and toe the Israeli line. And in this film, you interviewed her. She was the spokesperson in 2003 as well, when Rachel was killed. And she told you that the military conducted a long investigation and concluded that Rachel's death was, quote-unquote, a sad incident.
So this is exactly what I'm saying. It's not independent, because in this case, the army is being accused by some of the witnesses of intentional murder. So how can the army investigate itself? It's impossible. In the film, I have a long interview with the person who was in charge of the military investigation.
Cohen.
No, Avital Leibovich is only a spokesperson.
Yeah.
But this man, Shami Cohen, he was in charge of the inquiry. And he tells me very frankly that his inquiry isn't really worthy, because he didn't go to the place. He didn't gather testimonies from the Palestinian witnesses. He didn't interrogate all the foreigner witnesses. So what kind of an inquiry is this?
Cohen told you that it was hard for him to speak with Palestinians and the paramedics who took care of Rachel right after her death, because it's a war zone and it's difficult to go there. But
it's a war zone where they have all the power to bring anybody they want to them and to go to any house that they want to go in. It is ridiculous.
But you were able to find the Palestinians, Professor Sami and Abu Ahmad, speak with them. So how did you manage to get in, and how did you manage to find them?
Well, because as a matter of fact, I didn't manage to get in, because the Israeli army didn't let me myself personally go through the checkpoint. These testimonies of the Palestinians in Rafah, they are made by my crew without my presence. You know, the film went there with everything except me. I conducted these interviews by the phone, you know, with by remote control, because I was forbidden to enter the Gaza Strip.
So my question is, how did you and your crew track down the Palestinians that the Israelis could not?
Very easily. And they could have done it. It's again, if they wanted to interrogate them and have their testimony, they could. Of course they could. If me, with my very limited financial means and with the limitations of not being able to cross checkpoints, etc., if I managed to do it, anybody could do it, especially the Israeli army.
How did it feel for you as a filmmaker not being able to go to Gaza and talk face-to-face to the characters of your film?
Well, it's only one part of the film. It was very sad. Actually, I think it's the strangest and sad professional experience that I ever had. That week, I really felt that the wall, has won also on me. It was very, very hard. You know, a real documentarist is somebody who enters from the window when the door is closed.
You also spoke with a former Israeli reservist who served in Gaza from 2000 to 2003, and your conversation with him was quite revealing in the way that Israeli soldiers treat Palestinians. At some point during your conversation, he told you, as a civilian, I'm a pretty nice guy.
Yes, which is true. The whole story of dehumanization of the other side, which is, you know, the Israeli army is not the first one in history to practice this dehumanization. You take these young soldiers and you act in a way that after a while the civilians of the other side, in this case the Palestinians, won't be considered and felt as human being. They are not human, so it's not a crime to shoot on them. This is how it works. And it works on so many young soldiers all over the world.
So, Simon, can you share some of your conversation with him?
You know, as I chose him, and I was very happy that he accepted to talk to me and to talk in such an open way, you know.
But he had his back to you.
Because he has been serving in the exact outpost from where the soldiers who did the mission in which Rachel was killed. I mean, it could have been him, because he was doing the same kind of missions every day, going in his tank together with bulldozers who were destroying houses. So he could have done it the day before and the day after. That day, he was not on mission. And I asked him about not about this exact operation, because he's not a direct witness, but about what was going on in this outpost all the time. And he's telling me how they were destroying houses, how they were shooting at the windows of the houses where civilians were in the houses all the time, all the time, all the time.
And he calls the house demolitions as exposing the houses.
Yes, this is the official term which is used by the Israeli army, by the spokespersons, by the soldiers, by everybody.
When you were speaking with him, what was going through your mind?
You know, I might disappoint you. When the camera is on, all what is on my mind is that the image will be okay, that the sound will be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm doing my job, you know. And I respect the person who is in front of me. If it can be somebody that I feel close to what he's saying or not, it's not the matter. At this precise moment, he's giving me his time, his body, his language, so I respect him. And I try to help him to tell me the best way he can what he already agrees to tell me. So this is what is going on in my mind. I'm not arguing with the people that I'm interviewing. So, as you know, you are doing the same now with me. You are helping me to express myself. And this is what I did with this young soldier, like with anybody in this film.
And in your documentary, you use a number of footage from Israeli armies, official documents. How were you able to get a hold of these documents?
If you are talking about video tape, you know, coming from the survey camera, this was given to me, actually, by the Army Press Service. It was not easy to get it from them. It took me months of, you know, kind of negotiations, but they gave it to me at the end. Everything was hard with this film. It took me a long time to get the spokesperson accept to give me an interview, but in the beginning I was asking for more than that. I wanted to interview really the people, the soldiers and the commanders who were on the ground that day, and this I was not allowed to. They were not allowed to talk, and I was not allowed to meet them. They are very well protected. So at the end, it was not my idea in the beginning. I only got the interview with the official spokesperson, who is not a direct witness. As for the former chief of the military police, It was quite easy, actually, probably because he is not anymore in the army. He's a civilian now. And he accepted to talk quite, I know, it was not very hard to convince him, because he wanted to say these things. He wanted to express his frustration.
And throughout your film, we hear from a lot of Rachel Corrie's friends, ones who were with her on March 16th when she was killed. And in one of your interviews, you said that Rachel's friends in the beginning were quite suspicious in speaking.
Yes, it was hard to convince them as well. I think the main reason was that they had bad experiences in the past with media, journalists, that, you know, maybe, you know, manipulated their sayings. They had bad experiences of this kind, so they were very cautious with anything which has, part of them at least, were very cautious with anybody who has to do with medias. And also, for some of them, they were very suspicious by the very fact that I intended to make a film about Rachel Corrie's death and not, as they say, about the death of all the, you know, hundreds and thousands of anonymous Palestinians who were killed in the Palestinian territories or in Gaza. So I had to establish confidence with them, to show them my previous works, really to tell them, as I'm telling you now, what were my motivations for doing the film. And I succeeded in establishing this confidence, but it took time.
One of the scenes that was quite sad for me to watch was when, in the beginning of the film, Dr. Samir Nasrallah takes you through his house, sort of his virtual house, demolished by the Israeli forces. Yes. And he basically was taking you through his living room and his kitchen and telling you exactly what he saw the day that Rachel was killed. And this is the house.
He's a key witness. He's a key witness because he was in the house and he saw all of it from the house while the bulldozer was advancing to destroy his house. And Rachel was standing between his house and the bulldozer, and he saw it, you know, he's the key witness. And this key witness was never heard by the Israeli military police. And also, he's telling this on the very place where the house used to be and is not there anymore because it has been destroyed, you know. It hasn't been destroyed that same day because when Rachel was killed, they at last stopped their mission and they went away. But they came back a little later, a few weeks later, a few months later, and they destroyed it. And at the end, they destroyed the house, which is now, you know, it's only ruins.
And there are many scenes with bulldozers. And these bulldozers are D9, 49 tons, Caterpillar tractors that are basically made for Israelis.
I think the Caterpillar, I'm not sure actually. I tried to have an interview with one of the managers of Caterpillar, but they wouldn't talk to me. They wouldn't accept to talk to me. I wanted to ask them technical questions. As far as I know, the Israeli army gets these Caterpillars, and it is in Israel that they go and the process of armoring them.
So from the investigation that you did into Rachel Corrie's death, what did you come away with?
Well, I think I came away with a lot of things, although I didn't completely solve the question of did the driver intentionally, you know, at the last moment, decide to run over Rachel Corrie. This, he is the only person who knows. And until he's willing to speak, we shall never know. But what is sure is that the argument of he couldn't see her because there was a pile of dirt, etc., etc., what the spokesperson keeps saying, this doesn't stand. I mean, because all the witnesses are very clear with this. There was a pile of dirt which was not so big, you know, and he was coming from far. So from far, for sure, he could see her. So when I'm asked, did he intentionally kill her, I always say yes and no. I cannot say that he decided in cold blood, okay, here's this girl, I'm going to run over her. I don't think this happened this way. But I think that if he didn't see her, it's because he didn't want to see her.
What do you mean he didn't want to see her?
Dehumanized. It's like when the soldier is shooting at windows. He knew that there were human beings behind these windows, but at that moment they were not human beings for him. This is how it works.
And the Israeli reservist soldiers actually tell you that when he was shooting, at times he was just shooting for fun.
Yes, yes.
Especially the part that he spoke about having artichoke, which is a night vision camera, and they will shoot at the water tanks, and you ask him, but isn't water a precious commodity here? And he says, I didn't really care.
Yeah, he didn't think about it at that moment. I want to make it very clear. For me, personally, of course I believe in personal responsibility, but the real responsibility is the responsibility of the system, of the army as a whole and of the occupation as a whole. And if I'm talking in this film about a war crime, it's not the killing of Rachel Corrie. The real war crime, it's the destruction, the massive destruction of whole civilian neighborhoods on top of the heads of their inhabitants. Knowing that there might be people in these houses, inside the houses, or standing in front of the houses to protect them and taking the risk to kill them. This is the war crime, you know. The story of Rachel is something which put lights on this whole system. And this whole system, it's not decided in the head of one particular bulldozer driver, you know, reservist soldier. No, it's decided in the big tower in Tel Aviv of the headquarters of the army and the Ministry of Defense. It is there. The decision is there.
Indeed, it is there. Something very simple to know and remember when next you find yourself agreeing that the lowest guys in the totem pole of power ought solely to be charged for crimes of war. The real crimes, in my opinion, occur far from the battlegrounds in the office and suites of politicians and corporate CEOs who dream up the need for war while the Pentagon carries it out and we the people look on. Thanks to KPFA's Voices of the Middle East and North Africa for their telephone interview with Simone Baton, and thank you, Simone Baton, for doing the movie and bringing out these challenging questions. You're listening to Raising Sand Radio at Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore, reminding you that that free trade olive oil from ancient Rumi and Nepali trees can be yours by visiting the Rebellion Alliance. Go to their website if you are too far from Palo Alto to actually drop in and visit. That is rebuildingalliance.org.
I realized quickly when I knew I should that the world was made up of this brotherhood of man, for whatever that means. Into a crisis sometimes when I'm lying in bed just to get it all out what's in my head, and I
four non-blondes with What's Up introduce our next segment with Mary Wind, a member of a growing segment of the American population that continues to engage with the truth as we know it. Mary openly challenges her own assumptions and brings them to bear to the issues facing our world. In Mary Wind's case, she retired after a lifetime career with the Department of Public Health in California and became interested in issues concerning the Middle East. That interest and what she learned set her off in a direction she did not expect, including traveling to Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. I interviewed Mary Wind by telephone, and Mary began by describing her trajectory.
While I've been becoming more and more knowledgeable every day about the Middle East, I propose that I'm pretty typical of Americans, college educated and further, but having spent the majority of my life simply going through the process of living as an American citizen, involved in, marrying, having a child, and working for all of my life, what feels like all of my life, until my new life began. And so I was really involved in simply being a part of the society, thinking that I was pretty knowledgeable. I had majored in political science at the University of San Francisco. I had gone on and gotten further degrees, but the point was is that the world as a whole was whatever I was learning from the media, because I was busy, as I said, with everyday life. And it was really only before I approached retirement that I began to sort of look at the world beyond that scope. And as I did so, my interest in what would I do next, and that's when I actually realized I needed to go into the work of a nonprofit. I had spent the majority of my career working with people in the work setting, attempting to help both the individuals at multiple levels of working together to be able to work together better. And now that I was leaving that, I wanted to see what I could do to help in society. And that's when I began to learn about the United States and our involvement throughout the world. And the greatest education came for me really when I affiliated with a gentleman named David Dionisi. He's a founding member as well of the Teach Peace Foundation here in Davis, California, and it's international. And if the listener will just simply go to teachpeace.com, you'll find more about us and also more about the trip to Gaza than I can even tell you in the time allowed. But the point I wanted to share with you was, as David and I started talking and I began to say, okay, you have a message to share. He had written the book American Hiroshima, and it talked about the U.S. policy in the world and that if we didn't change our ways, we would end up having the same kind of thing happen to us that we did to someone else. And as we shared and talked, I learned and read and learned and read and listened and got on the internet, and we literally formed the foundation. I started out as its president, and in that role, full-time, obviously I felt the need to become more educated, which is how I've approached most everything in my life. And so I began to read. And the internet, I want to share with you, is a most powerful source of information.
Mm-hmm, it really is.
It really is. And so from the internet, I learned more. And recently we came back from Liberia and the U.S. involvement in Liberia and in Ghana and other places in Africa, I think, is notoriously how would I put it?
Underreported.
Well, yes, underreported and slave-based, in the sense that we have Firestone and we have gold and diamonds and all of these different interests throughout the world. So we've turned much of Africa into what I would call slave trade of a different nature. We use them to create the goods that we seek. And after coming back from Liberia, I have met over the last few years friends in what some call the movement of peace in the world. And I really do think that there are two key things in life that make a difference. One is what question you ask, because I think the question you ask bears fruit in everything you find and see, hear, and so forth. And the other is the friends that you make or the friends that you hang out with. And because I have found that the majority of the people involved in seeking peace for the world, and that means for many of us the right of all human beings in the world to feel secure and have the opportunity to have a sustainable life. And the more you meet these people, I have found, and I think you may have found the same thing, while some focus on specific areas in the world, many have multiple causes that they care about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would talk with one, and they would lead me to another and another. And it was through that kind of interacting that I began to learn more about the Middle East. And in all personal honesty in my life of 61 years, I am now at the point where I believe that is the center of the world's future. What happens in that area of Israel and Palestine and the countries right around there, what we do and how we act will be either for the better of humanity or for our demise.
And we're really woefully unprepared to take that on, aren't we?
As a society,
yeah.
We are completely ignorant. If I, a college grad holding a master's, perceived to be by at least myself attempting to be intelligent and knowledgeable, if I can be so ignorant of all of these key places in the world, and then literally the Middle East, I'll show you how ignorant I am, because I think that we learn from each other. I'll be very straightforward. One is that my image of Israel and the Jews is based on a background of having been a Christian as a child and having learned about Christ, and Christ was a Jew in the Holy Land, okay? That naive perspective told me Jews, Holy Land. Then to add to that comes a learning that now the Jews have been given a homeland, okay? Naivety again strikes when it comes to the fact that we have the Holocaust, horrifying event for Jews and others. So the idea, and this is a very naive idea, but I think one held by many Americans out of ignorance, not stupidity, ignorance, that having gone through the Holocaust, what a heroic, wonderful deed to offer them a land in the Middle East so they can now feel secure. Like others, totally ignorant, this was not a land with no one on it. This was a land with a whole human beings of similar concern and interests and desires as each of us. Okay, so in my naivety, I think Jews, Holy Land, Holocaust, now they have a place. Let's take that naive perspective. Then let's take another horribly naive perspective that, again, I'm afraid many hold. The first time I heard about Muslims in my life, and again, 60-some-odd years old, was really the Black Muslim movement, the Black Panthers. And again, because I was ignorant, the Black Panthers, while I had, and this again is just honesty, friends, very close friends, loving friends that are Black, Black Panthers, negative image, fear, and then, this image of, okay, so what are Muslims? Well, I there are Blacks changing their names to a Muslim name, Islamic name. Okay, I don't know what to think about that. Then you take what's happening between Palestine and Israel, between this area of the West Bank. And so that I, again, knew nothing, but I began to learn and listen and bring myself up from what one might call the bootstraps of being an infant or a child in naivety to an adult in factual knowledge acquired from reading, friends, internet, films, so many things, to saying, oh my heavens, what is going on here? So we decided, because we believe at the Teach Peace Foundation, that education is what it's about, that we have to start where people are at. And adults, I think in many cases, are childlike in their knowledge base. So I said, you know, that we heard that there was a group going to Gaza. We decided, okay, part of the holistic view of Teach Peace is we need to educate people, and one of the reasons we'll end up with an American Hiroshima is because of the naivety in the Middle East. So David, myself, went over to the West, you know, to Israel. We also wanted to understand perspectives of multiple peoples. I had already, and I knew I would be seeing, possibly negative images of the Jewish community in the world, in the West Bank. So we made a point to meet up with organizations of a peace nature who are located and started in Israel. Two of them I can highly recommend, though there were at least four others that we had hoped to meet with, and I know they're outstanding as well. But the two that we were able to directly contact and spend a day each with, one of them is Breaking the Silence. Now, many of your listeners may have heard of them. Otherwise, they need to go on the Internet again and simply look that term up and that phrase. And what they'll find is these are young men and women who have served their 3 years of military required mandatory service in Israel's army, and they have left. And after leaving, and I talked with one of the young men that was one of the founders in 2005 who had been stationed in South Hebron, some of the people he knew got together and started to talk about what they had done as young soldiers. And they have been educated just as I had been educated, with all its pluses and its humongous minuses of lack of truth and totality of knowledge. They had been educated, went right in, and then they did things that they now feel were completely, inhuman in the perspective of not right, disrespectful of another human being. And so what they do is they come out now and they simply witness what they did, just as we have had American soldiers leave the Iraq war and come out and say, here's what I did. You be the judge of its rightness or wrongness from an ethical standpoint. And these young men took us on a bus trip and took us to South Hebron. They pointed out the settlements, so we saw them. We saw their red roofs. They pointed out the outposts. They told us how the military bases are required as a response to any settlement. They have to bring in a military force. The outposts have the same right of protection. And then automatically the land around these areas and those areas are forbidden for Palestinians to go into, which is their own land. And one of the most diabolical realities that I learned about firsthand and even listening to the Palestinians as well is that once they come in and take the land away, or say, for example, a base is established, and the base then needs a firing range. Whether or not they even practice the firing range doesn't matter. They take up more land. Well, if that land lies fallow for 3 years, there is in the legal system in Israel that it now belongs to the state of Israel. So legally then, they proclaim that they have the land. So now the Palestinian finds it obviously more difficult, if ever, to get it back. And then to add to that, the Palestinians, and we spoke again to individual Palestinians who are sitting in a tent, one of which was next to a tent where the settlers came down and burned it down, and there were three men who had been in it. Luckily, they got out, and nothing is done to these people. But he even pointed out that in the law in the West Bank, in Israel, they are not allowed to build anything without, quote, a permit. Well, it's true that in the city of Davis, I need to go to the city to get a permit, but I can get a permit. They don't give the permits. So to build a house in the West Bank is to take a chance that it'll be mowed down, because they'll say you don't have a building permit, even if it's your land at this moment.
Let me remind our listeners that we're talking to Mary Wind, one of the founders of Teach Peace, and you were in Gaza the last time.
We were in Gaza on July 16th. We had 24 hours actually in Gaza.
Since you went through almost 60 years, you say, of
ignorance?
of not understanding this, what would you say to people now who are listening to this show saying, well, it's just another one of those liberal people, you know, they just don't understand, and they're self-hating Jews or so forth. What would you say to those people about why it seems important to you and also to me to try and get this different view of history out there?
Well, first of all, I can't be a self-hating Jew because I'm not a Jew, but I also have to tell you that it's important because truth is all we have to base our being and our actions on. And the truth that we as Americans have been taught is not the truth that is real. And what I mean by truth, I mean what others have lived through and what we have lived through in the eyes of both parties. So every war in our history has been laid out to us from one perspective that was ours, and that's ours from a governmental perspective, from possibly a corporate perspective. But the point is that we haven't brought in the views from the others that were in the middle of that fight, or ones we were supposedly fighting with, or supposedly bringing freedom to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important because that's what this time on Earth holds for us, is the opportunity to learn truth and then to be in alignment with that truth. And what I knew, and I'm as Caucasian as you can get, what I have been taught as a child is not the truth that brings in other people's life. And what I have found, one of the most beautiful things I have seen in my 60 years of change, is that America's population has changed, is changing for the better, because we are becoming and have been an open enough society to bring people from all over the world onto this land, that we are then able to have brothers and sisters, husbands and wives of friends we know that come from other countries or whose parents came from other countries. So we are able to learn an expanded view of what has been the history of this world. And it's important, you know, they say that if you don't understand history, you'll repeat it. I think it's more if you don't understand the truthful history,
mm-hmm.
then you will repeat it.
Well, I was struck by the story you started off by saying you had grown up a Christian and that you followed the teaching there, that the land was empty and that, you know, it had always been a Jewish land. And that is so true. When you get over there, you actually realize, and as you say, when you start to look into the history and do the reading, that that whole narrative about an empty land is simply inaccurate, isn't it?
It's a myth, and it's a myth I'm afraid those whose self-interest will benefit are continuing to work on, work with, and expand. And so if we don't, and this is crucial to me, if we don't spread the word being truth, and say, you need to go all the way back to the history before 1948, all the way back long before then, but even definitely before then in 47, when the Jews were brought in to the area of Palestine. You need to go back and understand what is truth and what is partial information. It's crucial. And it's crucial if I go into South America, if I go into Africa. The truth that we have learned is not the full truth. It is partial information. And even so,
some of that is really just logistical. Who was here first?
Of course.
And the bigger question is, how do we want to continue and evolve the world?
Yes, it is.
Isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's always that. It's no. And thank you for reminding me or putting that focus on there for me, Susan, because what matters is what we do from this day forward. And sometimes we need to go back to understand enough to open up our eyes to listen to each other. When we finally got into Gaza, I was horrified. It reminded me of my childlike image from one of my classes of Dresden, after we had bombed Dresden right before the end of World War II. It was a moonscape to me. There wasn't even the traffic there had been the years before. The buildings that are blown out. I mean, we stood on the ground of the UN, the international school that was bombed, and the children were killed, and with the white phosphorus. We stood on the different land that in essence they've been using to, you know, weaponry that has depleted uranium in the soil. When we crossed over from Cairo, my head, my eyes, the migraines, it was horrendous. I have such a strong feeling for all people and the injustice. All I want to focus on, but I want people to educate up to here, is that they need to see injustice, whoever brings it on and whoever is living in it. We have to help those who are being affected by injustice. And what I mean by justice, I mean, one, there is just us. And it's how just us treats each other.
Hmm. And Mary, what about the people that who disagree with you? Have you had friends who have been put off?
Yes, I have friends who disagree, and I respect each person's right to make a choice. And all I ask of them is to consider something like, do me a favor. From our friendship, go on to teachpeace.com. You can start with that. The July newsletter is focused solely on our trip to Gaza. The August newsletter will be focused solely on our trip to the West Bank. Go on to the internet and type in the word Israel/Palestine. Type in, you know, whatever, and there will be so many opportunities to then go and start learning.
In fact, I've had Israelis themselves say to me, you know, in the old days we would say, nobody knew what the Germans were doing. She said, now we have the internet and everybody can know, everybody can go and find out the information. That they don't is more telling about what they are willing to know and what they're willing to not know.
And I agree with that, and I'm also terribly afraid, though, that I understand the... what one might see as unwillingness to know. It is trying, very challenging to begin to know, because at first you can feel, or I felt overwhelmed. I had to literally, and this may or may not connect for you, when I first began to wake up to the fuller truths in life about my own government's actions at times or other governments' actions and so forth, it was especially my own. I at first went through a phase, again, back to the childlike time, where, you know, the motherhood and apple pie and the sense that there's a fatherly image of the United States, I think, that is perhaps taught in schools. There's sort of that image of the fatherly image, not the motherly image, but, again, the fatherly. And so when you suddenly see that the fatherly image is not true, you know, it's just like as you grow older, you find out your father or your mother weren't quite all the things you thought, or your myths or so forth, or are shaken a bit. And then you begin to see them as a person, a more whole, real person. And I did the same with my own father. And at first you're shaken, and you say, oh, do I really want to know more? Wouldn't it be better to go back, mm-hmm. to go back to the image? Mm-hmm. And that takes a little time to get... past that.
And I think it's really important to reiterate this, that, you know, it's almost like a culture shock, isn't it?
Everybody, oh, yes.
Yeah, and it is, you do go through a period of mourning, and I think it's very important to recognize and respect that period of mourning.
It's extremely important. I'll go a step further. In my family, there are addicts. Drug addicts, alcoholics, you know. I mean, I had a wonderful raising, very good opportunities in life, which I will always say there, but for the grace of God, how lucky, you know, go I. But the point being that in spite of that, I've been very lucky. I understand addictions. I understand them because I saw extremely intelligent people become addicts. And I saw them stay addicts for years and years. And some die as an addict, and some become alive again. But I also understand, and in my career, I had to be familiar with all of that. And I also understand that the decision to wake up, and that's what I meant by to be willing to look for honest information, truthful, holistic information about your own government and or your even yourself. You know how hard that can be. You go through. If I can take a moment to be a little bit more, even more honest, when I divorced my first husband, my son was only 7, and I went through a whole, how can I do this? You know, how can I do this? The guilt feeling, because my parents had divorced when I was young. And I realized that I did it, and then years later, I had to forgive myself for what I'm sure my own son must have gone through. Because no matter what, in a divorce, children go through hard times. And there's a point where I had to forgive myself. In looking back at the myth of the fatherly image of the U.S., to give that up is like the addict giving up the drug. To say, Mary, you're an everyman, you know, you're an every person. You have done things that you wish you didn't have to do or didn't do, but are you going to forgive yourself? Are you going to see a new image and still love? I love America. I want the best for America. And the only way I can see that the addiction of the old image of America, we go through, if you understand addictions, there is a point where you go through like the black hole. You go into a void and feel alone. That's another reason why it's very important to understand people and why they may be afraid of knowing too much, because they're going to go to places where they have to be willing to sort of reappraise and get through that black mourning period, as you pointed out. And so it's important to be there to help them get through it. It's important to nurse them with information bit by bit, not, one might say, throw up on them, which is the human tendency. I am a passionate person. I want to help people wake up. But I need to step back and say, just say, do me a favor. You know, check out a website. Do me a favor. Talk to a friend. Learn a little bit about Islam. Learn a little bit about Judaism. Learn a little bit about Christianity, fundamentalism. Learn the beauty of each of these offerings, of Hinduism, all of them. And then learn to see the sides that we all are, human, the mm-hmm. everyman. And then, as you said, Susan, start from where we are, mutual respect. And it's a strange thing. You know, when I saw Obama speaking to that sergeant, I think, and the gentleman over that whole issue of the possible racism that might have been involved in having, you know...
Louis Gates, Jr.
Thank you very uh-huh. much, Louis Gates, yes. And when I saw Obama and you know, speaking with the two of them, having a beer together, I first thought, well, that's what is going on here. And then I stepped back and I said, wait a minute, Mary, maybe this is a perfect opportunity, because he showed that he's an everyman, in that he said, come to my place, have a beer with me, talk to my to us, let's hear each other's sides. Let's leave with the mutual respect of saying we can agree to disagree. Do you know what that setting brings in somebody? The security of knowing that that person over there can respect me in spite of the fact that I have a completely different view frees me to potentially listen a little closer next time, mm-hmm. open up a little more.
And that's,
you know,
actually in a very real way, I think that's the freedom that we're all looking for in this country. It's the freedom to be as fully human as we can. Isn't
yes.
it? Yeah.
We do. And, you know, your program, your show offers, just go to any one of those shows that someone can, you know, you have so many phenomenal shows. You've had so many wonderful people on your radio show, that the people can open up and listen to any of these shows, and that would be a perfect start.
Thank you for that.
And it's true.
Yeah, it's raisingsandradio.org if anyone out there is interested.
Yes, and I assure you, I will tell them about Raising Sand. And it shows you, again, I didn't know about you, and I don't think you knew about me.
That's right.
But because we've been asking the questions, because we've been opening up, we're all finding each other. And the more we keep that connection expanding, we're up against the greatest challenges our Earth time has ever faced. And it's only together, across causes, and learning about each other's and opening up to help each other, that we will be able to meet these challenges.
Thank you for that, Mary.
I'm so excited. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
It's a pleasure. Now, let me remind listeners that they can go to teachpeace.com and learn more or download the newsletters that you mentioned. And you're one of those co-founders of Teach Peace.
Yes, I am.
They can get in touch with you there if they want to.
Yes, they can. Or if they go to the contact, they'll get in touch with David Dionisi. And I'll tell you one thing: if there's information, you know, I figure sometimes, like, you know, I sometimes feel like I'm the one that expresses things with this passion, which is positive and or negative. But David knows so much, and he will gladly share or redirect people or answer any questions. So if they go to the contact page on Teach Peace, they can ask anything, and he will either contact me if that is what's needed, or he will help them with what, you know, the information that they need that he can definitely direct them to.
And we'll have you on again. Please let us know when you have another trip coming up. We'd love to get some participants on that trip. And we'll stay in touch.
I will definitely let you know.
That's Mary Wind of Teach Peace. You can learn more or contact Mary Wind at teachpeace.com. And that's our show for this week. As usual, views and opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. You're encouraged to contact me directly at Susan@RaisingSandRadio if you'd like to express your opinion. And we really do encourage expressions of opinion. That is how we begin to engage with one another and figure out exactly what it is we believe and how we want to live our lives. We'll go out today with you two and Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses?
You're dangerous, 'cause you're honest. You're dangerous, you don't know what you want. Where you left my heart, empty as a vacant lot. For any spirit. Who's gonna fall?